Hello, and welcome to Onward, the Fundrise podcast, where you can find out more about what's happening at Fundrise and where you'll hear in-depth conversations about big trends affecting U.S. and global economies. My name is Ben Miller. I am CEO and co-founder of Fundrise. Before we get started, I just want to remind you, this podcast is not investment advice. It is intended for information and entertainment purposes only. We have a special guest today, Steve Ross, who is the chairman and founder of Related Companies, an organization with more than $50 billion in real estate assets. Related Companies currently ranks as the second largest owner of rental apartments in the United States, with approximately 250,000 units in 44 states, and is one of the largest owner developers of affordable housing nationwide. Steve may be the largest real estate developer in the world. He is also the owner of the Miami Dolphins. As a quick aside before we get started, I just want to mention Steve and I talk about 80-20 housing, which is a type of tax-exempt government financing for apartment building construction, which requires 20% of the units to be rented as affordable housing and 80% as market rate. The idea is the market rate units and the low-cost financing subsidizes the 20% affordable housing. So as a heads up, this interview has a lot of real estate inside baseball and is likely to be most interesting for real estate professionals. Now, without further ado, Steve Ross. Steve, welcome to Onward.
Onward. Upward.
Yes,
which exactly. Which way, onward or upward?
I have a lot of ground I want to cover, so I'm going to just jump right in. The idea here is that you have 50 years of experience.
More?
Yeah, 60. So technically 60. 50 years of real estate.
The company is 51 years old.
You were at Coopers & Lybrand. So much of real estate used to be about tax.
It still is.
So you have the long view, right? So real estate has changed over the decades. How has money changed in the industry, both equity and debt?
Well, that's probably one of the biggest changes is the availability of money. Before, the lack of liquidity in the marketplace for real estate was great. So it's a question of if you can get the money, you would develop. But at the same time, there was tremendous business cycles then. They were much more frequent than they are today. And so there was a lot of boom and bust with regard to real estate. But finding equity was probably the most difficult thing. There were no funds. There weren't a lot of individuals really investing. The tax impact was much greater. And the IRS code was used for social purposes, for getting money into affordable housing. It still does to a lesser extent, but it still does that. And the tax laws were much more favorable. And that has changed from what it was when I first went into it. Being a tax attorney, I knew what the tax laws were, and I was able to adjust as the code became more difficult for real estate development.
Why do you think it changed so much?
There were so many people using real estate deductions that were made available to real estate to reduce their taxes. And then there was always been the constant complaint that the legislatures was looking at to reduce the tax impact and tax benefits to the wealthy and the few that were investing in real estate.
Yeah, I know they passed that bill under Reagan.
Every time there was a tax kind of reform, they really chipped away at.
So where did money come from in the 70s and 80s? Where was equity coming from back then if it's not coming from funds?
It wasn't coming from funds. The banks were participating more on equity. That's what I was able to find. I mean, that's really how I benefited. I dealt with the commercial banks until they had their crisis. Early 90s were investing more in real estate. You can see with the savings banks, that's why we had the crisis that we did. I mean, I was searching the savings banks, but also the commercial banks were doing a lot more investing in real estate, providing equity or 100% loans. I mean, when I started, I was able to borrow 100% of the cost of a project and I'd guarantee a certain portion of it and give them a piece of the deal. That was certainly eroded by how regulations, what banks could do after they saw the tremendous losses that the country suffered with the savings and loan crisis. That changed real estate as much as anything. Fed saw how much losses were attributed to real estate back there in the early 90s.
Most people don't know that much about the SNL crisis and the Resolution Trust Corporation that got formed to try to fix it. I know you were right there. You saw probably the run-up to it and then the way government policy approach.
Then the result was every developer, no matter how big you were, suffered from that. And that really brought on the REITs. And then the major developers were able to form REITs to survive. And that's how real estate really changed, because so many of these private entrepreneurial real estate developers who were big had to form a public REIT and do their business as a public entity as opposed to a private entity. That's really probably done as much as anything to really changing real estate development in this country.
That's my observation, that the 92 crisis brought on, basically birthed CMBS, birthed securitization market for real estate.
That came from it, but I mean, there were steps of how it happened. First was the REITs itself, where the entities survived. And then the question is, and then once they survived and raising equity from the public, how did they then finance those projects? From there evolved the CMBS and all the structured financing that came with that, that you could apply to do with public companies a lot easier. Then the funds came when that got difficult. You can just see the transitioning of what real estate was when I started. And that's probably the way it was for many years before I even started, but then to where we are today. Then today you have so much availability of capital. Anybody can go get it through all these funds. You don't necessarily have to be a public company to do it. I mean, the biggest change in real estate is the availability of capital.
So what's that impact on real estate in terms of, like, do we build different things in the 80s or 70s versus now? What is the person who lives in a building and the person who shops at a building? How do they experience that difference?
I don't know if they're going to experience differently. For a while it was the REITs. That was probably a little bit more professional people. It wasn't quite as entrepreneurial. And now it's transitioned because the availability of money, more entrepreneurial people are in it, probably doing more so than the REITs did. So, I mean, the trend today is, I think, everybody wants to go out and raise money and do a deal. I don't think you can really build a large company doing that like we built. Our timing was great. You're right in the middle of all of it. And I always look to stay private and not be a fund. So I think it's allowed us to have flexibility, less regulation, private company, financing the deals, but not giving up equity in the company.
The bottom of the real estate crisis in 92, you bought a couple billion dollars of distressed notes.
We did that with funds.
Partners.
Yeah, with partners. But that wasn't partners in the company, it was partners in those deals.
How do you think about managing crises like that? Because I have a mentor always say a problem is an opportunity. You're a sportsman, so is the best defense a good offense? Because you went through 92 and 08, which are two horrible real estate crises.
The best offense and defense is flexibility. And therefore, you got to be able to go both ways. You see where the equity is. You want to adapt to it. And you don't want to be owned by them. You want to be them partnering with you. And I think that's really the difference.
The policy response in 08 was diametrically opposite of 92. The government policy in terms of how they bailed out. In the SNL crisis, they shut down every bank, and 8,000 banks were shut down by FDIC. How do you think about the policy response? Did the government learn their lesson? Is it, will the generations forget the next crisis?
The government never learns its lesson. That's why we had the mortgage crisis in 2008. Everybody in the world of real estate knew what was going on. I did. I would assume everybody would have saw it and saw all the fraud that was being committed. It was all the securitizations, how that got out of hand, almost destroyed the country economically. So there's so many things that you see and the government doesn't react to. Realize there's always people seeing how they can beat the system or be the first ones there. Usually the first guys are doing it, it makes sense. And then people see how they build upon it and things get easier and easier and people create an opportunity and everybody wants to jump in. And then all types of people who are running it jump in because greed takes over. that continues to this day. There's just going to be different waves of it. It's irresponsibility of government. We know what's going on, and they keep allowing it. There's no question they should have seen the fraud that was occurring with those securitizations and stopped it right there and then. And there's things today that the government allows to happen. They're late in stepping in.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that at the end, but you teed it up. The market's in distress now. It's about to break. Where are the vulnerable or fragile parts you feel like last time you knew, right? So this time it's, do you have a sense where to look again?
Well, I mean, right now there's a crisis, in affordable housing. I mean, that's going to be the biggest need in the world. And, as we grow, as our city, as our country grows, and as we go through a third industrial revolution, in the country, and, how do you provide? And people are looking for the government to provide different things, but you've got everything changing. You got communication changing, you got transportation changing, you got energy changing. Everything is changing, and where is that going to end up taking us? And at the same time, you have people, who don't want to work today, or they want to be at home. They don't want to suffer.
Most people don't know you. I think you're the biggest owner developer of affordable housing in the country, right? So okay, what do you recommend? What's your policy recommendation then to solve the crisis you're saying is imminent?
Well, I mean, basically, you can't keep growing out and building affordable housing. And no neighborhood wants to say, everybody talks about the need for it, but nobody wants it in their backyard, We used to call it subsidized housing. Any way you look at it, it's housing for those who are less fortunate. They can't afford to pay rent, okay? And as you become successful, you don't want to be with those people who, are less fortunate than you. It was, to something better, even if you came from there, right? Problem is, it's harder and harder today to aspire and be successful with what's going on. So, and today, as we look at it, we need, there's got to be more mobility amongst people economically, right? We'd like to say that. So how are we going to provide for that? And then the costs have gone up like crazy. I have a simple solution. When you look at every city and everywhere, you'll see areas outside the core of that city. They're the older parts of the city where the people who live there don't own their residences. They're all kind of low in density. And then you skip out before you get out to the suburbs and all that kind of stuff. What we have to do is allow the government to provide for housing, to be able to use eminent domain, to take those properties, to pay the people for what it's worth, what's on the property today, and then upzone it for density and build mixed income housing.
Is that federal? Is it a federal law, you think?
It's going to have to be federal and state because you can't get caught in the courtrooms. It'll never happen. But if the state and federal have a policy, they're getting paid for their properties. But then you're building mixed income property, housing, on that property, because that's where the crisis is really going to be. Then you'll be able to do what everybody wants, is to really have a more homogenized society and at the same time provide for the housing that's going to be needed and make it also more resilient because you don't have to provide for all the transportation because it's not far out, eliminate congestion, and you create a live, work, play environments. That's what I believe is the future. I don't know of any other way. You can have all these great urbanologists and sociologists and everybody talking about things, but you got to be practical and understanding what it costs to build and what people's needs are and where it goes. And we can't continue to keep pushing things out and everybody saying it's not in my neighborhood. If we bring people together to live together, they're going to find out it works. When we started in our rental housing in New York City with the 80-20 program. And everybody said, I don't want to use it because I won't be able to rent out the 80%. And we had to take people off out of a lottery. So we didn't even know what we're getting in terms of the other. And the income levels are super low. The disparity between the market rate rents and the 20% was greater than anywhere else in the country. And we built these 80-20s. We built it to the highest level. We got the highest rents. And it was incredible to see what the 20%, which we took out of a lottery, how they kind of thought they went to heaven. If Titan went to heaven, they're living in these beautiful buildings. They ended up doing much better, the way they dressed, the way they respected people and everything else. People will live together. They've got to be proud of where they're living. And I think if we can create new neighborhoods out of these older parts of the city that are close in and where there's jobs and creating even those areas, live, work, play environments, we can really do a lot of change that could really benefit everybody. And I think that's where the future is.
Yeah. It's funny because the 80-20 seems to only work in New York.
They work all over.
I can never fake a pencil in DC.
See, what New York has done though, because most places have archaic tax systems. New York, they had a system at least where they gave you relief on the tax law, which helped make it work. Chicago just has adopted the same thing. We got the legislature in Illinois to allow us to build 80-20s in Chicago or anywhere. And it's a question of the government, how they provide and use these tax exempt bonds and incentivize people to do things. You got to look at things differently.
So you went through the 70s where interest rates went from 5-6 to 21% in 81. How did you navigate that? And someone is saying, like, how do they navigate it now? It may not be as bad. It might get a lot worse than people expect. What's the playbook here?
I don't want to give away all my secrets. There are ways to finance things. And I think the government recognizes they can use their tools properly and not be taken advantage of. It's where the government sets up and allows things. It gets to the point where people really take advantage of it. That's the savings and loan crisis. It is how we got into all these kind of problems that have existed in the past. But now we have a major problem. And then we got to look at different ways to solving those problems.
Okay, Alan, I don't want to talk about today yet because most people don't know your full career. So then in the 90s, you transitioned your business to start building these mega projects. You built Time Warner Center, which 2.8 million square foot mixed use development. I remember in the early 2000s, every real estate professional would go visit it because it was such a cutting edge project. And I thought it was huge. then you build Hudson Yards, which is 18 million square foot, $25 billion. You've done small projects and you've done massive projects. How does scale change the way you make decisions?
Because of the availability of money, most one-off projects don't work. They're marginal. Can you make a living, but can you really get wealthy from it? The old American way of doing things and wanting to succeed ran inside me, and it still does, but not everybody feels that way today. But today, when you look at the cost of land and the cost of construction and the movement that it's got to be in union, and the cost differential is so great. In New York, the cost differential is at least 30-40%.
How does scale help that problem?
There's no way you can build in New York today, large projects, because there has to be union and the cost is so great. And today, you know, who's going to pay those rents that it takes? And now with increased interest rates, great, when interest rates were really low, you could really cover up a lot of things. But now with interest rates the way they are, the fact is the real estate tax laws and the incentives don't exist. So there's going to be virtually no building going on in New York.
Yeah, most of the country.
I don't know how you're going to do it. That's a problem. Land costs being the way they are, construction costs rising, and the availability of money, which is really the key factor. Everybody was doing it. And that's what caused land costs to escalate. There were so many. So people had all this money available, and then they said, Jesus, all these jobs are being built. And all the rich real estate guys are getting too rich. So let's start eliminating the incentives, what it took, which you needed. So they eliminated that. And then as the cost of escalated interest rates, there's no construction. There's nothing that's feasible and nothing will get built. During that period of time when you were either starting, we saw with land costs going that it was very hard when you're building to anywhere from 5 to 6% returns on cost.
If you're lucky.
If you're lucky. And you saw where cap rates were, people would build for such a small amount that flipped the projects because there was a demand for people wanting to own real estate. And interest rates were so low, so the spreads were so thin. A lot of building was going on. But now all that's turned and there's going to be no construction because you can't afford it. There's not availability of money. I always saw, though, as this was happening, if I had tied up land to mix in large scale projects, they weren't one-offs. I got the advantages of the synergy of the different uses. And this is what the city needed. Hutchin Yards was really creating a live, work, play environment. And on a different scale, you wouldn't do it everywhere because this was too of a high level, even though we do have affordable housing in it. As part of it, I thought that this is what we were looking to do. And we're doing these large scale projects now. We've already one in Detroit, West Palm Beach, Santa Clara, California, and middle of Silicon Valley. We have several other large projects that are mixed use where you can get the synergies and you can get the premiums of doing it. And oftentimes you can get some incentives to do it. They're so impactful. So that's why we're doing these large projects. And it was just too hard to buy properties. Today, young people want to live in the cities. They want to live in the downtown areas. And that's the hardest place to really find land to build.
We're at the end of a cycle. We just went through a 15-year cycle where cap rates went from, I don't know what they were at the beginning, 6, 7. And now they went down to 3-ish at one point.
Yeah, certain places, yeah.
Certain places, maybe even 2.
The interest rates were nothing, and people figured they were still getting a spread of 100, 150 basis points.
Right, so all the quantitative easing, printing money, they had zero interest rates. Now all of that's going in reverse. They're quantitative tightening, they're destroying money, and their interest rates going up, we have inflation, cap rate. So how do you think this plays out over the next few years?
Well, I mean, we're going to have to wait for interest rates to come down, obviously. I think the government's going to have a land policy, like I talked about, where you can develop mixed-use projects right on the edge of the cities and in the domain to do that. They used to do that way back when with
Robert Moses.
Yeah, with urban renewal, things like that. You had to eliminate the abuses where developers would get selected and sit on the land for years because they were selected and not developed. You got to work together with the cities and making sure that what we've done, we said we were going to do a project, we really got involved in and we didn't sit on it. We did sit on Hutchin Yards for several years because what had happened with the Great Recession and there was no market, there was no, I mean, yeah. You know, had to rebuild.
Getting that platform finance was very hard.
Right. And it'll be hard to do the second phase because of the cost of the platform. Anyway, I think we're going to have that realization of what's going on and then how government's going to work together to get something done. Yeah, I think it more or less being realistic. In other words, I think being realistic, you got to understand the trends, you understand the politics, knowing where the pockets of capital are, and knowing what people are looking for. And that's what's so exciting about being in the real estate development business. It takes every aspect to really put it together, be successful. And it's been a wonderful career I've had because I've just loved every minute of it. It wasn't like working. And you're making a major impact at the same time.
Okay, so you have singular experience, vast experience over decades. We're talking to 30-year-old Steve Ross, and you're looking at the future, looking at trends. What's the advice? What are the trends to follow?
You're going to have to work with whatever community you are. I mean, I started in affordable housing. I think it's a great place to start. One, there's less risk because you don't have market rate risk in terms of selling or renting because there's such a demand. And you got to learn how to develop. For young people, nothing that you're born with. There are many skills that are involved in that. So you got to learn a trade, more or less. And I think you can grow from there. I mean, fortunately, I guess I have a short time frame. And so I learned, you know, I went from residential to office to retail to hotels to mixed use. And I did all of that working with different people, looking up divisions of doing that. So it didn't happen overnight. But I think you got to learn what you're talking about, seeing what works and what doesn't work.
I find not all developers can do that, though. Mixed use in particular is just so different.
And how do you, the question of how do you activate, how do you really create a place that attracts people that want to be there, place me at its best. That's all part of it.
But it's like making a good movie, though. It's easier said than done.
Not every movie is good either.
Exactly. Okay, well, we're getting short on time here. Let me ask you just sort of like a more open-ended sort of question, which is like, if you had a magic wand that could do anything, what would you do?
Well, I mean, like from my perspective of what I could do, like I said, I would want to create the fact that I can assemble these parcels to create the housing, the mixed income housing that's so urgently needed, creating in a way with great places and using the latest in technology, energy efficient and energy clean, because I think that's so important going forward that during that period of time, we create a lot of jobs. I think it's important that people get back to work, working together as a team, not staying at home. You can't learn to work together over a telephone or a screen. Human interaction that's really necessary in working together. Eventually, we'll hit some low point. We got to hit a low point where people recognize where we are to bounce back up. And I don't know where that would be, but I think that when you start seeing all these changes that are really occurring and that you got to be together and working as a team to make it work for everybody and for yourselves, that's what's got to happen.
Yeah. Well, if that's what could happen with your magic wand, everyone would thank you.
Well, you got to work it.
Not so much these days.
People have to recognize it. That's the whole point.
I think people do or just seem to be stuck. So
yeah,
wonderful. I really appreciate taking the time. It's been a phenomenal conversation.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
You have been listening to Onward, the Fundrise podcast featuring Steve Ross, founder and chairman of Related Companies. My name is Ben Miller, CEO of Fundrise. We invite you again to please send your comments and questions to onward@fundrise.com. And if you like what you've heard, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Be sure to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information on Fundrise sponsored investment products, including relevant legal disclaimers, check out our show notes. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next episode.